The Buddha was once asked a series of questions by a monk named Ajita, one of which was, "What is the world's great fear?" And the Buddha replied, "The world's great fear is dukkha, suffering." Yet, even though this is our great fear in the world, it's also the first of the Four Noble Truths. Without coming to know this first noble truth, we won't begin to know and understand the other three noble truths. So the four noble truths are, there is dukkha, or there is suffering, there is a cause to dukkha, which is clinging, there is an end to dukkha, and then the last noble truth is the path to the end of dukkha, the end of suffering. So this is what we're going to take a look at tonight, the four noble truths. When the Buddha gave his first sermon after his enlightenment, which was called the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, he introduced the Dharma to us, or to the world, with an explanation on these four noble truths. Of all of the vastness of his understanding, he summed up the essence of his discovery with these four major insights that he had on the night of his enlightenment. He said that these four truths were all we needed to know in order to realize freedom, that suffering and freedom lay within them. It's said that these four truths are the realization of all Buddhas of all time when they are finding a path to freedom. This is what they discover, the Four Noble Truths. It's these four truths that are hidden from our minds through ignorance. And then a Buddha comes to being and he reveals these truths to us and gives us the path. So they're called noble truths in as much as they're discovered or uncovered, you could say, by a Buddha and subsequent enlightened beings, subsequent arhants. And these are called noble beings. Hence, the four truths are called noble truths. But they're also called noble because they're the changeless, timeless truths of our existence, the fundamental truths of our existence. So when we hear about the Four Noble Truths, it's not that we're to kind of learn the four sentences of the Four Noble Truths and then we know them. It's really about steeping ourselves in them, immersing ourselves in them right here on retreat, which is the perfect place, and in our lives, so that they become manifest, we see them within our lives. And then in this way, the truths are uncovered from the darkness in our own minds. So let's take a look then at the first noble truth, which is our great fear. The Buddha makes the statement, there is suffering. There is dukkha. It's not my suffering. It's not I am suffering, it's not life is suffering, but there is suffering. It's there. It exists. So it's a simple and direct statement of truth. There's nothing personal in it. There's no judgment on anybody around this noble truth. And it doesn't belong to anybody. So it's not that we've done something wrong and therefore we're afflicted by dukkha. By virtue of the fact that we're here as human beings in the round of samsara, there is dukkha. So there are a number of translations to this word dukkha. So far you heard me use the word suffering. And this is probably the most common translation of this word dukkha. But this can be a bit of a limiting translation of dukkha, because although it includes pain and suffering, it actually means something much more than that, something wider, something more significant than simply suffering. As a noble truth, it points to the inherent unsatisfactoriness of everything conditioned. And everything in our world is conditioned. What is it conditioned by? It's conditioned by impermanence. Therefore, it is unsatisfactory. There's nothing very satisfactory about things that are impermanent, constantly moving. So we might use the word unsatisfactoriness to best describe dukkha. And often this is the word that we'll hear, the unsatisfactory nature of things, which means the suffering nature of things. And then too, of course, sometimes it's left untranslated, and we often simply just use the Pali word of dukkha. So there's no exception when it comes to dukkha. Everyone experiences this first noble truth. So it's not only those who are suffering in some obvious kind of way, like some kind of hardship or perhaps poverty or some kind of trauma in their life. Even those in the best of circumstances experience this first noble truth of dukkha. So rather than avoiding or denying this truth of dukkha, which we've spent most of our lives doing to the best of our ability, trying to run away from it, get away from it, occupy ourselves in some way to keep ourselves away from any form of discomfort, because of course we can't avoid it. In fact, trying to avoid dukkha is dukkha in itself. So rather than doing this, trying to avoid it, what the Buddha suggested, what he instructed us to do, was something quite revolutionary. He said that we should turn towards dukkha, acknowledging its presence. So let's take a look at the different kinds of dukkha that we might experience in any moment, because there's basically three different kinds of dukkha. The first kind of dukkha, which is something we've probably all experienced right here as we've been sitting, is body pain. It's called dukkha dukkha. It's something that none of us particularly like. Discomfort in the body. And it also includes mental stress. Anxiety, unhappiness, various mental stresses that we can go through at any given time. So that's the first kind of dukkha. Then the second kind is called the dukkha of change. And the Pali word here is viparinama dukkha. But we can call it the dukkha of change. And this is, of course, that nothing lasts. In particular, with this kind of dukkha, we're asked to look at the fact that pleasant is dukkha too. Now, years ago when I sat my first 3-month retreat at IMS, it was a nightmarish 3-month retreat. There was acute body dukkha, head to toe, and there was also acute mental stress, anguish, every kind of mental anguish that you could imagine that I experienced. So in the middle of this 3-month retreat, going through all this acute dukkha, I come into the meditation hall one evening, a teacher's going to give a Dharma talk, and the topic is the Four Noble Truths. And the teacher proceeds to talk about dukkha, but in particular he talks about this kind of dukkha, the dukkha that's in pleasant experience. So here I am sitting in the hall in agony from head to toe, mental anguish like you can't believe, and here he's telling me that pleasant experience is dukkha. So I'm thinking, well, give me a break. There's no dukkha there. What I am experiencing is dukkha. I am no dukkha. But after a while, after some time, I began to understand what he was saying. If we take a look at the pleasant experience that we may be having in any given moment on the cushion here or at any other time, but particularly on the cushion because mindfulness can be strong and we might notice it more clearly, underlying that pleasant experience is a mild discomfort in the mind or a mild kind of an anxiety that it's going to change at some stage. So there's this kind of feeling of how can I keep it here, what can I do, when's it going to change, and can I experience more of it right now so that, you know, I get, you maximize the pleasant experience. All of this goes on within us, and that is dukkha. So it's very helpful to begin to notice this. So that's the dukkha of change. In our worldly lives too, at any moment, our pleasant worldly circumstances can change at any time to unpleasant. So then there's the third kind of dukkha, and this is called sankhara dukkha. This is the pervasiveness of suffering, that it includes all and everything. It's sometimes called the unstable nature of formations. It's also called the conditionality of things, because really everything is coming together and falling apart. Coming together and falling apart. All the time. There's no resting place. There's really no solid ground. And this too is dukkha. One time, years ago, I was sitting on the beach in Cape Town in South Africa. Perfect conditions. The weather was beautiful. The ocean was beautiful. I was happy. I was sitting there. It was very peaceful. But as I sat there, I began to have this kind of strange feeling. I just didn't know what it was. Like some kind of shakiness of some sort. But very, very subtle. Some kind of an insecurity. I didn't know what it was because I was feeling really very good, very at ease and comfortable, etc. So I asked my teacher at the time, well, what was this that was going on? Everything was beautiful and wonderful. And he said, that is dukkha. Underlying all experience, if we take a closer look, there's just the dukkha of formations, the pervasive nature of dukkha. Experience coming together and falling apart all the time. No resting place whatsoever. So in announcing this first noble truth of suffering, the Buddha then went on to describe exactly what it entailed, in case we weren't clear about what it was. So this is what he said. Birth is suffering. aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Association with the unloved is suffering. Separation from the loved is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And in short, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Now, the five aggregates is what this mind and body is. That's all that this is. So this, the five aggregates right here, this too is suffering. Sometimes, talking about dukkha, as I am right now, can be construed as dwelling upon it. But that's not what's being done at all. It's not that we're being taken towards the miserable. That's not the Buddha's intention at all when he explained what dukkha is in this way. So it's not a case of, well, woe am I with all of this suffering. That wasn't his intention. On the contrary, it's to help us see it simply for what it is, to take the identification out of it, so that we could simply see it more clearly. What is dukkha? This is what it is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All 12 of his different descriptions of dukkha. So that we can then say, oh, I see, this is dukkha. This is what it is. This is what it consists of. Because if we don't know that there is suffering and what it is, we're not going to begin to look for a way out of suffering. Find a path, or the path, to freedom, to look in the right direction towards freedom from suffering. So instead of feeling perhaps deflated or depressed on hearing about dukkha, we can then just begin to acknowledge the truth that it's there, and then knowing this can help for us to take it just a little bit more lightly. Because of course it isn't personal. It's not personal at all. At the same time, it's not that we hold it with a kind of a flippant or a cold energy at all. That's not what it is either. It's more about an open-hearted acknowledgement of this truth. That's what it is. Because when we recognize that this truth is present, when we recognize that there is dukkha, it's this that's going to prompt us to look for happiness. So the Buddha said in relation to this first noble truth that it needs to be understood. So how do we understand dukkha? By feeling it, by experiencing it, by coming to know it directly in our own experience, opening to it. And this is very difficult. Usually, as we all know, when there's any painful or unpleasant experience, what's the first thing we do? We do our best to get rid of it, to pull away from it if we can. Because it's painful. It's painful to open to dukkha. And it's a process. It's a process of gently learning how to open to this first noble truth. Because it can take a long, long time for us to get the point in practice that it's not about pleasant experience. You will hear me say it, you've probably heard Marcia say it a number of times, it's not about pleasant experience. It's about opening to what is. We also have to hear very clearly that it's not about unpleasant experience either. So it's not about pleasant experience, nor is it about unpleasant experience. It's about opening to what is. So truly coming to know dukkha is letting whatever is there simply be present, opening to it, acknowledging it, knowing it directly how it feels. So this takes considerable gentle tenderness of heart to allow for us to open to this truth, because as I say, it's not easy. So it takes a compassionate, tender heart to help us open to this truth. So by opening to dukkha within our own body and mind, what does it help us do? It helps us to realize that this is what everybody else is experiencing as well. So through opening to our own dukkha, it helps us to meet humanity, to connect with humanity, that this is what we're all living with, we're all going through. So it leads also, opening to this First Noble Truth leads to our connecting with the compassionate heart, which is beautiful. Because the proximate cause for compassion to arise is opening to dukkha. So by opening fully to this First Noble Truth of dukkha with the support of the compassionate heart, we come to understand it. And the result of coming to understand this First Noble Truth is that we see that there is a cause. And thus we open to the Second Noble Truth. Through seeing directly the First Noble Truth, through understanding the First Noble Truth, we come to see that there is a cause, and that this cause is craving, is grasping, clinging. This is the origin of the suffering that we're all experiencing. And it's essential to know the cause of suffering, just like the diagnosis of a disease, we might say, because if we know what the disease is, then we can find a cure. What do we usually do when we're suffering? We look for anything to blame it on. So usually we blame it on something or someone outside of ourselves. But sometimes we blame it on ourselves in the I'm bad kind of way. I'm not a good person. Or we blame it on the unpleasant experience or the pleasant experience. We blame it on that. I'm suffering because I've got a pain in my knee. It's the pain in the knee's fault. This is what we usually do. But with investigation, what do we come to see? We actually come to see that it's the grasping of desire that is the suffering. That the suffering is in the mind. So there is pain in the body that we're always and until we die going to experience. That dukkha is going to be there. But the dukkha that we can transcend, the suffering that we can transcend, is the suffering in the mind. It's the grasping at desire. This is the root cause of the suffering that we experience. So we're asked to simply recognize that desire is present. That's what we're asked to do. Just recognize that desire is present in the mind. Not get rid of it. Because this is what we often think. Ah, there's desire, I've got to get rid of it. Got to do something with it. We're asked to simply recognize This is the experience of desire. So we continue to work to opening to suffering, opening to the First Noble Truth, by seeing how it arises and recognizing the various kinds of craving that are present in any given moment that we're experiencing dukkha. Because there are three kinds of craving. So what are these three kinds of craving? Can you guess what the first one is? Sense desire. This is the first kind of craving that we have. Craving for pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches. And you will have seen this. We will sometimes do anything we can to have that desire fulfilled. Sometimes we'll bulldoze our way through and over others simply to get what we want, because it can take over the mind so strongly. Then too, there is the craving, the grasping at blissful meditation experiences. We know that one quite well too. We've all had that experience in one way or another. So that's the first kind of craving, craving for sense pleasures. Then the second kind of craving. This is craving for existence. And this means craving for future becoming. We've all been experiencing this too. How might this come about? It's really very simple. It's wanting something in the future, to become something in the future. Wanting to be a kinder person, a better meditator, a more generous person. All of these things that we want to be in the future, this is future becoming. Or we might think of the new relationship we're going to have, the new job we're going to have, the new house we're going to get, the vacation we're going to go on. All of these things are becoming something in the future. So it's also called craving for future existence. Basically, it means leaning into the moment that hasn't arisen yet. We're not here with this moment. We're becoming the next moment. Leaning forward and going to be this other person in the future. And then we have these fantasies around how we're going to become. A particular fantasy of mine was how generous I was going to be by giving all this money that I was going to win away, and how I was going to be this wonderfully generous being. This was like a repeated fantasy in the mind. So we all have something like this in one way or another. So this craving for existence. Then the third kind of craving is craving for non-existence. So how does this manifest in our experience? This is the wanting to get rid of or get away from what's here. So it's pulling away from the moment. So how would this manifest? We want to get rid of our anger, get rid of our jealousy, get rid of our pride, get rid of whatever we think we have that's bad, you know, not the good things. We want to get rid of them. This is craving for non-existence, pulling away from the moment that's here, not wanting to exist in the moment that is here. And then it can manifest in our daily lives too. Wanting the conversation to end, wanting the Dharma talk to be over. You know, it's like wanting things to be over with. Let them finish. Wanting the dinner party to be over. All of these kind of things are pulling away from the present moment. Wanting spring to be over so that we can be here in summer. And then we find that with that fantasy, we project ourselves onto some outdoor activity that we're going to take up. So we find we vacillate from one to the other, pulling away from this existence and reaching forward into the other existence. And they're all manifestations of craving. This is how we live. So these three kinds of craving arise because of one core reason. They're all given birth as the result of the wrong view of self, the wrong view of me, of mine. The idea that this is me and my experience. This is the birth of suffering. As soon as there is this is me and my experience, from that comes, I want this pleasant experience, I want to get rid of this bad tendency of anger, I want to become a more generous person. All of that is born out of the wrong view of self. Me, it's my experience. The attachment to the idea of me and mine. But desire is not about me and my desire. That little bit of me or my desire is to be dropped because it's simply the arising of desire. So the second noble truth is not about judging ourselves in any way. I'm so attached. I've got so much greed. I'm so ambitious. I'm such an angry person. It's not about that at all. That's very much wrong understanding. It's about seeing its presence in us. Simply seeing that it's there. Not acting on it, but seeing that it's there. Not wanting it to be another way, not trying to get rid of it, but simply seeing that it's there. So we practice with this. We see it arising in the mind. And we see how craving for things to be another way only operates to create suffering. And this is what we continue to see as we look and work with the second noble truth. See how craving operates to create suffering. And also we investigate how identification with any experience at all causes suffering. It's the same thing. Grasping. Grasping or identifying with any experience at all is going to give birth to suffering. So the Buddha said, related to the second noble truth, that it needs to be abandoned. The first noble truth was to be understood. The second noble truth is to be abandoned. So we're to abandon our thirst for wanting or attaching to something. Let it go. Let it go. That's what abandoning means. Let go. Let go. So notice that in any moment that suffering is present, there's going to be a want. Just keep noticing that. Because it usually seems that if the other person just did a little something, then it would be okay. And we often miss this, that there is just this little want. If they would just do this little thing. Quite a number of years ago, I was trying to sort out something with my mother, trying to explain something to her about the person I was and my life as I had grown up. And she didn't understand. And I really wanted her to understand. And it took, you know, quite some months I was working with this and talking to her about it. And after a while, I began to see very clearly this very strong want in me, that I wanted her to understand, and she wasn't understanding. And because of that strong want, there was a lot of suffering in me. And so through reflecting on this and feeling it for a while, I let go. Could it be okay for her to not understand? And it was. I let go of that need for her to understand. And the result of that letting go gave space for love to come in. And so out of this we can see how destructive wanting is. It operates in such an obstructive, destructive way to create separation, to stop connecting with others. So it's very helpful to take a look in our daily lives at how we relate to others in our life, what we want from them, and how that can be destructive and cause suffering, create separation. We also find that we hold on to things that we think are going to bring us some kind of lasting, pleasant experience. The simplest of things. And if we actually take a more careful look, turn the mind to it, we'll see that actually that pleasant experience doesn't last. Take a very simple experience. We go outside in the snow, we're out there for a while, it's freezing cold, maybe we take a long walk, and we come in and we think, oh, all I need now is a hot shower. So we take a hot shower. After 5, 10, maybe 15 minutes, what's happened? We've had enough. It's not pleasant anymore. We don't want that hot shower. Now we want to get out. It's become unpleasant, in fact. So this is what's very helpful to keep looking at. That pleasant is going to change to unpleasant. The same thing with eating something nice. You know, you eat a nice piece of chocolate cake, have one piece, and then, you know, another piece. Halfway through the second piece, it's ugh, you know, and we feel kind of sick because we've just had too much. It's that same thing has now become an unpleasant experience. So it's just helpful to look at these very ordinary worldly experiences and learn from them. Wisdom can arise out of a piece of chocolate cake. Because change happens. It happens all the time. And we keep forgetting this. We buy something new. We think it's this thing that's going to bring us a lot of happiness and fun. Years ago, quite a very long time ago, before digital cameras came in, my husband and I were going on vacation. And so we had talked about this and really wanted a nice camera. One with the long lenses. Comes in quite a big bag, box, you know, shoulder strap thing. And we had it for the first day or two. It was a lot of fun. But then it turned into this enormous burden. It was like an anvil around our necks. We had to, you know, you've got to watch that it's not stolen. You know, you change the lenses, get the lighting right. By then the scene has changed. It became a pain in the neck. So, you know, whereas at first it was just going to bring us, it was going to make the holiday in the end. It didn't quite ruin the holiday, but it was a burden. So this is the kind of thing that happens. You know, we miss, we don't see that the other side of things, another possession is going to make us happy, but after a while it just becomes clutter. Or we buy a new car. Quite a long time ago, I bought a new car, and I watched the anxiety in me to try to keep it new. Eric, don't get dirt on the carpet. Watch that scratch. And the suffering I went through around this new car. Then after a while, oh, it got its fourth scratch. It was, oh, it's old already. The car is old. What a relief. So just let that go. Oh, it doesn't mean that we stop taking care. We do. We continue to take care. But we let go of holding on to things and expecting them to stay in their original way, because they're going to change. So all the while what we're working with this, we're learning. The mind is developing wisdom. It's coming to understand. If we cling, there's going to be suffering. Nothing lasts very long at all. What's new becomes old. So by noticing these three kinds of craving, we investigate, we reflect on the suffering that arises, and then we begin to fulfill the second instruction that the Buddha gave us. And that is, we begin to abandon. We begin to actually let go. And this abandoning, this letting go, can happen on a moment-to-moment basis. When we're mindful, that's what it's about. It's being mindful in the moment. Because if we're mindful of what's present, we're not acting upon it. We're simply mindful that this is desire. We're not acting on it. And out of this, we come to see that it'll end by itself. It's not the result of us doing anything. We have to get rid of the desire. Okay, that's that. Just by being mindful of it and watching, we see desire arising. We're mindful of it, and with time it's going to cease of its own accord when conditions change. So we come to see, come to understand that wanting, that desire, is just another empty arising. It's no different to joy, sadness, anger, or anything else. Just another conditioned arising, conditioned by impermanence. So it's not my desire, because that's where the problem comes in. As soon as we put the my in it, that it becomes my desire, then we think we've got to do something with it, that we've got to get rid of it or act on it. Fulfill it in some way. So when we have the strength, the staying power, to not act on a desire that has arisen, and simply be there with it, and watch it disappear as it does, we then really see very clearly that desire is impermanent. And we have to see this quite a few times to get it in there. See, desire is impermanent. It's born and then it dies. It comes to be and it ceases to be. And it doesn't have to be fulfilled. No different to any other arising in the world. Just another conditioned arising. Being caught in a want of any kind is very painful. We all get caught in some kind of desire, something in the mind. It grips us. And it's very, very painful. And then we hear about the second noble truth of abandoning, letting go, and we want to let go. We have to be careful of this too, because this is also clinging. It sounds good, and we want to be there already, but we may not have reached that place. So here we have to really bring in the patient staying power of our mind to just recognize, okay, there is a want here, it's not being let go of right now, but we're just going to keep working with it slowly, gently, practicing relinquishment in a very gentle way, with a willingness of heart to work in the direction of letting go, with a lot of patience and compassion too, because we cannot force letting go. It's an organic process as wisdom grows in the mind. So there are many qualities that come into play as we're working with this second noble truth of working with abandoning. It really brings in the quality of patience, the quality of determination, the quality of kindness, compassion. So as we continue to work, with the Second Noble Truth, seeing how suffering is caused by clinging, the clinging that comes, the suffering that comes with clinging. The mind is developing wisdom all the time, as I say. Then we come to abandon. We actually fulfill the Buddha's request for the Second Noble Truth. We abandon. And the result of that abandoning is the end of suffering. The result of letting go is the Third Noble Truth, the end of suffering. Now, there are a number of degrees of letting go. We need to keep this in mind. There is full-blown 100% letting go, and of course that's Buddhahood. Okay? The result of that is that we will be completely free from any suffering whatsoever. But there are degrees of letting go, lesser degrees of letting go. And the result, which is also has considerable, it's a result of considerable wisdom, the result of this letting go is that we experience considerable peace, considerable ease of mind. And that letting go comes about naturally as the result of wisdom. And what is the wisdom that's arisen in the mind? It's the understanding of the impermanent nature of experience. Desire, for example. When we see deeply that this is another empty, insubstantial, unsatisfactory arising, letting go happens. So what's happened as we've been working with these first three noble truths? Delusion in the mind is slowly diminishing, and wisdom in the mind is slowly growing. There's a transformation happening in the mind. So letting go happens because wisdom does it. It's not me that sees this, me that sees, oh, I am suffering because I am clinging, so now I must let go. It's not that. It's wisdom that does it. Wisdom lets go. Yeah. And the letting go is as a result of seeing that everything is just conditions arising and passing away. When the mind sees this really clearly, it has no interest at all in holding on to something. It just doesn't want to do that. Why create suffering? It just does not want to go there. So this is the development of wisdom in the mind. This letting go can happen also at any moment in our daily lives. We'll see it over and over again as we begin to work with it. You're at home and your husband or wife, or you're going to a movie and he wants to go to a cowboy movie and you want to go to a romance. And so you hold on to what you want, you hold on to it, and you know, maybe this is what you usually do, and you suffer, and there's an argument, and you know. But then as you begin to recognize, wait a minute, because I'm clinging, there's suffering. Oh, it hurts. We let go. Doesn't matter. We'll go to a cowboy, we'll go to a comedy, we'll go to... Doesn't matter. There's that kind of letting go inside. And then we feel the freedom, the relief of not having to have things our way, our want met. It can happen in any small experience just like that. A few years ago, I was when I was training with Joseph in teaching, I went to Spirit Rock for a couple of weeks, came back home, and as I was just arriving to go into my driveway, I noticed that the Department of Works, the municipality in my village, had chopped down all of the trees in front of my house, and I'm on a, you know, the so-called busy road. Not my trees, but the ones on the street that had been very nicely protecting me. And like in one instant I saw like, like all of the noble truths. First of all, there was this like this semi moment of, oh, you know, oh no, and I could see the mind that I want to lean in and like just get upset and think of suing and a million things. But before it even landed there, it just thought, this is going to just be so much suffering to hold on to that. It just let go. And then in the letting go, there was, oh, you know, don't go there. Just let go. And then there was peace. But this was, you know, quite a big thing to just see that, let go. It was, you know, not my usual style. But this is what we keep looking at. It can be anything in our lives. And the more we get the flavor of the experience of letting go, the experience of freedom from suffering, freedom from clinging, the more we know that taste, the more we incline in that direction. We get to know, oh, this is peaceful. Why cling? Why hold on? Let it go. So we incline more and more towards ease, towards peace. So it's very important for us to recognize these small, simple letting goes. Because the more we recognize it, the more we'll incline in that direction. So there's the big letting go, the final letting go. There's kind of intermediate letting go, you can say, through a fair amount of wisdom. And then there are momentary wisdom, letting goes just in our life, just letting go. We're sitting in the room here. There's an unpleasant sound. We grasp at it. Oh, this is bugging me. I want this to go. And the moment we see that we're holding on, we're wanting something to be different as we're sitting here in the hall, we let it go. There's ease. The sound, unpleasantness is still there, but we're not wanting it to be any other way. And so there's ease. So we can see it in all areas of our lives. So, as we come to know the taste of the ease of having let go, the mind then knows, oh, this is what I need to do. This is the direction that I need to move in order to be peaceful, in order to know the taste of peace. So this then leads us towards the fourth noble truth. The fourth noble truth, the result of the third noble truth, is that it shows us how we need to live in order not to suffer. The path we need to take in order not to suffer. And this is the middle path. The path of not clinging and not pushing away. Being in the middle path. And the middle path is the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha said that related to the fourth noble truth, the path to the end of suffering, this needs to be developed. So this is what we're doing. We're developing the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path, in order not to suffer. So the first noble truth is to be understood. The second noble truth is to be abandoned. We abandon clinging. As a result of abandoning clinging, we come to realize the end of suffering. And out of realizing that, we know how we need to live. The fourth noble truth shows itself, the path to the end of that suffering. Knowing these four noble truths really is the crux of our practice. It's pivotal to our freedom from suffering. The Buddha said that to believe that one can realize awakening without having understood the four noble truths is like trying to construct the upper floors of a house without having constructed the lower floors and the foundation. It's not possible. So we truly come to know and understand these four noble truths by bringing them to life in our practice here on the cushion and in our daily lives, bringing them to awareness. And in this way, we're actually using our lives in an onward leading direction towards freedom. So let's sit together for a moment or two.